This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In the late 1990s, Lisa Hyto Weidman was a young medical student in the South, and one of her very first patients was a gay man from rural Virginia. He was blind from an opportunistic infection resulting from HIV, and he died alone in a hospital because he didn't want to tell his family he was gay. This clinical moment was a turning point for Lisa. She'd recently decided to be open about her own sexuality and was honorably discharged from the Air Force, and she began to get increasingly interested in how HIV affected the gay community in particular. Lisa went on to become an infectious disease specialist, and her team eventually helped discover that the HIV epidemic in the South was growing among young black men who have sex with men. Lisa is a professor at UNC Chapel Hill in the Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases, and she also directs the Behavior and Technology Lab at the UNC School of Medicine. Dr. Lisa Hyto Weidman joins me right now. Lisa, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. So great to be here.
Take us back to those early days. You were born in Baltimore, right?
I was. I was born in Baltimore many, many years ago and lived there for about 14, 15 years. People who are from Baltimore love Baltimore. They're, you know, true sports fans and, really grew up sort of in a neighborhood community feel, lots of friends, lots of school.
Tell us about your family growing up.
Sure. So I grew up with, sort of initially a traditional family, and then my parents separated when I was, I guess, about seven or so. I have one brother, younger brother, who's a chef. He's 4 years younger. And, you know, until I think, divorce happens, you know, you're sort of living kind of the basic childhood. When divorce happens, my father moved around quite a bit with jobs. And eventually, when I was a little bit older, he settled in Florida first and then in New York. And my mother remarried when I was about 13.
And you did not get along well with your stepfather.
Yeah. Well, we had, a challenging relationship. I had lived with my mother and my brother for many years alone without sort of a male influence. My stepfather came into the picture and didn't have any children. And I think there was a struggle in which he sort of wanted a family to sort of be the father figure for. And for me, I already had a father who may not have been in the house, but who was very present in my mind. And so we did not necessarily see eye to eye in many areas.
Well, you were forced to leave, weren't you?
Yes. So, again, these struggles got a little bit, more intense. Again, at the time, my mother had found someone who she loved and who wanted to be married to. And I think the decision really was that she, at the time, chose her husband. And that choice forced me to leave.
And as you said, you kept a very close relationship with your father, though he was moving around a lot. And it was a sense of humor that really kept you going through some very difficult times.
Yeah, my father's a character. I mean, I actually think you probably should be interviewing him. he thinks that, too. He hasn't always been my sort of strongest supporter and my best friend. And he definitely has, a great sense of humor. The best sort of outlook on life that of anyone you'll meet, and he definitely also has a touch of sarcasm, which I probably have inherited as well, and he used that to certainly sort of keep me my spirits up, and even during times when moving to new places, I didn't have a lot of friends or was confused and scared about sort of what was happening.
Especially as an adolescent, when that's a tough time anyway, even if everything is stable and going well. I think there's a story about cupcakes that illustrates how he tried to keep you and your young adolescent life buoyant.
Yeah, when I moved to New York, from Baltimore, I didn't know anyone, started school. I hadn't realized, I think, before that I was shy because I had grown up with a lot of friends. So didn't have to kind of enter new social situations. And being forced to do that, I realized, I didn't quite have the skills to kind of, again, sort of fit into groups that had been established. So I joined the field hockey team. I was pretty good. And one of our pre-game dinners happened to be around my birthday. So my dad said, we should bring cupcakes. I said, okay, that sounds good. He says, as he's dropping me off, he says, now, I didn't want to tell you this, but I put little notes inside each cupcake that said, please call me. I don't have any friends, with your phone number.
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah. So I wasn't quite sure if he was kidding or not. And I watched every single person eat that cupcake. And, you know, he did not put it in there. But it did, you know, again, I think it did give me, you know, more additional confidence to continue to meet folks and eventually fit in.
I think the humor and probably just the sense of that close relationship. But also it suggests, I mean, the introvertedness would be consistent with the personality of a bookworm. You love to read a lot and were expecting or had thoughts perhaps at some point of being a writer?
Yeah. Again, I like to think of myself as maybe a bookworm who was also a butterfly. You know, I don't think I love to read and I love school. I mean, I was really a very focused on school from a very early age. And I was an English major in college at UCLA. I loved all kinds of literature, English literature, Russian literature. And I thought I'd be a writer. I thought that I would, you know, write novels or poetry. I had a, you know, a torn up notebook that I put my, you know, my words on when I was feeling very passionate, which I read recently and, you know, good thing I did not choose that as my career.
See, but you kept it.
Right.
Good for you.
So, I thought that's sort of what I would do. I, you know, I admired kind of the writing and the idea of being able to tell a story through words.
Then you get a side job in college as an EMT.
Yeah. So I started, you know, at college at UCLA and was working and decided, you know, really sort of off the cuff, I thought the EMT job would be great because it paid well, which is, you know, key as a college student. And you could get sort of rid of 24 hours of work over a weekend so that you could really kind of still have your whole week to, you know, do your work.
And as an introvert with no friends, you don't even
no
need
friends,
a weekend, right?
So. Right? So I signed up and, you know, and quickly kind of went from basic EMT to a little bit more advanced. I met, you know, some great folks there, had a partner that we ran our shift, you know, every Saturday night through Sunday. And I loved it, you know, and I fell in love with sort of the team approach to caring for people. I loved interacting not just with patients, but with families or friends, since we had a lot of folks on campus who needed us. And, you know, from then on, I think, you know, I realized that whatever I did, it would involve some aspect of medicine. And I became a, you know, second sort of biology or minor in biology to get my science coursework up.
So this is a real opening. Now, again, you're at UCLA at the moment. This is an opening, a kind of an awakening for new possibilities for you and also the beginnings of political awakening because you were living in the Westwood neighborhood at the time, right? Then this is around the time of the Rodney King riots.
It was. I think they were in 92. Mm. So we were living in Westwood at the time. And, you know, again, I think you know, the riots happened, you know, obviously further sort of in L.A. and in the city. But we had the National Guard coming into Westwood to, you know, protect us from rioters. You know, again, at the time I was young, I was, you know, certainly self-motivated. And I think we were, you know, scared. You know, I think it also impacted our ability to leave. We were on a curfew. So we were, you know, probably a little annoyed. But you know, at the time, I didn't quite realize sort of the implications that, you know, what the riots were about and how they really sort of impacted, you know, the community in a lot more significant ways than, you know, having me have a curfew and not be able to, you know, leave our you know, swank little Westwood, you know, apartment.
Was this a turning point? Did you come back and reflect on that? And you might call it a naivete. And I mean, that in a way, reflecting on a sentiment like that can be an opening again to a deeper political consciousness. And I don't know if that did that for you.
Yeah, I think many years later, you know, I've certainly, you know, sort of reflected on, I think sometimes history continues to repeat itself, unfortunately, and things that we think we've improved upon, maybe we haven't made as much progress. And I think certainly there's been, you know, things that have happened, you know, over the last few years, particularly that, made me reflect back on that experience. And, you know, as I'm now much more, I think, active, much more vocal, and much more aware of sort of others, not just myself, I think certainly, you know, reflecting upon that is something that's come back to me.
So also at this time, your brother came to live with you. Tell us how that happened and what impact that had on you.
So, you know, my brother's also another character who would, you know, would he calls himself Hollywood Haito. He's a chef. And my brother is super smart, but my brother was not always the most studious and motivated as I was from sort of a school perspective. So he got through high school and he went off to college, and he went to, if you were from the West Coast, he went to a college called Chico State, which is well known for its party atmosphere. And within, I think, a few weeks of starting, he took himself out of school and took the tuition money to use for recreation, we'll say. When my father found out about that, he was not thrilled. And he suggested that my brother find something to do with his life. At the time, he didn't really know what to do. He called me up and he said, you know, sis, what should I do? Can I come live with you? And I said, sure, I have a basement. So he moved to Virginia, and I said, but you got to get a job. And so he worked at a sandwich shop, and then he worked his way up to, you know, being a chef.
Say, well, we'll take a break here and find out how you got from UCLA to UVA and became a doctor when my conversation with Lisa Haito-Weidman continues, infectious disease specialist at UNC's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Disease. And our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking today to Lisa Haito-Weidman, an infectious disease specialist who directs the Behavior and Technology Lab at UNC's Chapel Hill School of Medicine. So we were talking about the fact that you ended up at the University of Virginia, but that was because of your decision then to become a doctor. So tell us about that.
Yes. Yeah, so, you know, again, I think despite my love of writing, I realized that it probably wasn't practical. I also, you know, wanted to have a job that was stable. So I applied for medical school and applied it at, you know, lots of places. But UVA was had sort of a magical quality of sort of Thomas Jefferson and sort of the lawn and the cobblestone streets. And I really just fell in love with it.
Went there, also then decided to join the Air Force because there's a price tag that comes with med school, turns out.
Yeah, I think it's higher now than it was then. Yeah, yeah, you know, again, at the time, the idea of sort of being part of something larger, something that, you know, an organization that was sort of designed to help people was appealing. And certainly the, you know, coming away from medical school without debt was very appealing as well. I had a really dear friend who was joining the military to pay for medical school, and it seemed like a great idea. So I applied, and I was accepted and sworn in. My dad came to the ceremony, and, you know, again, I thought that was kind of going to be what I did.
So you're in the Air Force. You're also at UVA Medical School. You've made this career shift, or at least in your mind now, you're more clear on what you want to do, and it's medicine. And also at this moment, you're coming more clear about your sexual identity. Tell us about coming out in your own mind and sort of that transition while you're in school.
Yeah, for me, you know, again, I had, you know, gone through college. I had, you know, mostly dated men, you know, and had, you know, great relationships. I had some very intense friendships with some women who were sort of best friends. But in my mind, you know, I hadn't quite made the connection that the best friendship was probably more of sort of love on my end, at least. And when I got to medical school, I think I really just started to realize that the relationships I had with women were much different. They were much more intense. They were much closer. And I felt a connection that, you know, to me really sort of made it very clear that I was gay. So it wasn't as much of a coming out and sort of feeling this need to kind of identify myself, but just sort of a gradual realization that, you know, for my life, I can see myself having a long-term relationship with a woman, having a family, and kind of being content in that role.
Did you sense any resistance to those ideas initially?
From my own self?
Yeah.
No. Yeah. You know, again, I had, you know, growing up, I think I had struggled during the time that I was, you know, kicked out of my house with sort of understanding sort of why I was different. You know, why wasn't I living, you know, in Baltimore with all of my friends? Why did I have to kind of make, you know, start over a few times? And what did I have done wrong? And I think I had sort of resolved that, that, you know, that I, you know, again, I wasn't perfect, but not everything was my fault. And so when it came to my sexuality, it didn't, I didn't feel bad about it.
Yeah.
I didn't, I wasn't sad about it. I just sort of, it was sort of, it was what it was. And, I just didn't have sort of that, the angst that unfortunately a lot of right. other people do go through.
It sounds like you were fortunate in that you were able to come to terms with who you really are. And once you can become comfortable with your identity, then all of those other markers that come with it and the true God-given nature of your sexuality is something that you can accept. So that's a nice moment for you. Your consciousness is growing and you're starting to also get a deeper political consciousness at this time and social consciousness. And you're starting to read the work of Randy Shields.
Yeah, so I was, I mean, I was in the military.
Yeah.
And again, sort of also realizing that I was gay. And at that time, started to read a book by Randy Shields called Conduct Unbecoming, which was, you know, an amazing book, but also very frightening from for somebody who is somebody who always plays by the rules. You know, I as I told my son who got his second note sent home from school the other day, I never got a single note sent home from school.
tell us about that book.
Right. So, it, you know, for me, the book was really about the persecution of gays and lesbians in all the armed forces branches and, you know, what happened to them when they came out or when they were found out. And again, this was around the time of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But, you know, again, you may not realize this quite from this interview, but that was never my style. And so I quickly sort of realized that I just couldn't stay in the military if my life was going in a direction where, you know, I knew I was gay. I knew I would be with a woman. And I couldn't stay in this organization that didn't want me.
So what did you do?
So I told when they didn't ask, I had the help of the Land Legal Defense Network. They helped me kind of write a letter that it was tricky because you had to tell that you had intent to be gay, but you couldn't have acted on any of it or else you could have been prosecuted. So, you know, it was a fine line between sort of, you know, ensuring that I could be honorably discharged because I didn't want it to impact my life. You know, I didn't feel like I had done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. I was just being honest. And they, the military had a lawyer and they quickly, you know, got in contact with me and basically said, we will honorably discharge you as long as you, you know, sign here and pay us back for any amount of money we've paid thus far for your medical school education.
You were able to do that. You did that. And then so what's the next move for you?
So the next move for me is sort of realizing I'm out of the military. I have a lot of money that I owe. Luckily, again, my father came to the rescue for some of it. Thank you, Dad. And, you know, I think, you know, I was with in a long-term relationship with a female partner at the time. And this is really when I fell in love with HIV. And, you know, the next book I read by Randy Shields was In the Band Played On, which is, you know, really chronicles the early stages of HIV, not just from the medical side, but from the social side, from the political side, from the cultural side. And again, I think for me, that is what I fell in love with, is not just sort of the disease, but all of the things that impact whether somebody with the disease gets treated, gets into care, and what happens to them.
Well, what was it that was new for you or what opened up for you in those realms, the cultural and political realms that was revealing for you?
Well, you know, again, I think when HIV first came on the scene, you know, marginalized groups were certainly impacted first. They continue to be to this day. But, you know, because it was labeled as a gay disease, as the gay plague, as the gay cancer, we did not have the response we would have had if white, heterosexual, 50-year-old males were being impacted and dying the way folks were dying at that time. So we had a president who didn't mention it. We had, you know, a lot of stigma that started then and has persisted today. And, you know, for me, as someone who, again, identified as gay, but also who really felt, you know, a kinship to folks that were struggling to sort of, you know, understand who they were, this, you know, the stigma and, you know, the homophobia that surrounded the disease really impacted me and really kind of made me passionate about it.
Tell us about your experience with your first patient, your HIV positive patient.
So I was in medical school. I was a medical student. You know, as medical students, you know, you're sort of sent off to go do your history and physical. You come back, you report, you know, you do as best you can. And then everyone, you know, finds things you messed up on. But the first, you know, HIV patient that I was interviewing was on a medicine rotation. And I went in the room and, you know, I realized pretty soon that he couldn't see, was probably legally blind. He was covered in sort of these pustule-looking bumps that were something called molluscum. He spoke very slowly, very softly, and he was dying. And he was dying of an opportunistic infection, and his CD4 count, his T-cells, his immune system was very weak. And he knew he was dying, and he was alone.
And he was going to stay alone because he didn't want to talk to his family about it, right?
Yeah. He was from the mountains of Virginia and had known he was sick for a long time but hadn't come in because he didn't want to die of AIDS. He hoped that he would have died of something that no one would, you know, his family would have known that it was HIV related.
So what impact did that have on you? Because I understand that when you went into med school and your training, you were thinking you'd want to be an emergency room doctor, but things changed for you and you began to think more closely and deeply about infectious disease. Was that the moment for you? Was it a moment?
I think that was a moment. I think, you know, the other sort of moments that stitched together is, you know, I really loved forming relationships with people. And, you know, in the emergency room, you don't get to do that for a long time. You know, you have to, it's a short, action-packed visit. And in medicine, that really is one of the few specialties where you really get to spend a long time forming those relationships. And for me, that was really important. And so I think it was sort of the combination of that piece and then sort of knowing, you know, right away that HIV was where my passion was, that kind of forced me in that direction.
See, you pursued your residency at Stanford and created your own HIV elective, right? Tell us about it.
So I went back to the West Coast for residency. When I got there, I sort of had assumed that there would be all this HIV because it was the West Coast. It was near San Francisco. And how can there not be, you know, every other patient, you know, having HIV? And when I got there, there wasn't, you know, any elective. There wasn't any chance to engage with HIV patients that weren't in the inpatient unit. So I worked with the staff there and created an elective where I was able to go to the county hospital, to go to the VA, some of the clinics, as well as get some, you know, experience kind of seeing what happens in an HIV lab. And that, again, I haven't been back there for a while, but at least when I left and for a few years after, I know that elective continued.
And tell us about it on the timeline. What year was this?
So I was in residency from, I have to go backwards, from 1998 to 2001.
And even by then, even, you're saying there wasn't an elective in this.
Correct.
In Northern California. So at this point, too, now your brother is coming back, right? He comes back to live with you and you reunite with your mother. Tell us about what's happening with the family at that time.
So my brother, you know, he bounced around but ended up going to culinary school in San Francisco. So he lived with me while I was in residency in Stanford. We kind of lived halfway between San Francisco and Stanford. And he was graduating from culinary school. And I was getting ready to move back east to start fellowship. And my mother and her husband, my stepfather, were coming out for his graduation. And my dad, you know, thought, you know, why don't we give this a try and reunite everybody? So we planned a dinner after my brother's graduation, which, again, I will give a shout out. My father paid for. Nobody offered to provide any money for him. But we all got together, and it was, it was a start. You know, it was sort of a, we hadn't seen each other and talked in many, many, many years. And, you know, I think by then we'd both, I don't want to say forgotten why we stopped, you know, why we had such a bad relationship. But I think we had realized that it wasn't worth it anymore. At least I did. And I think, you know, the idea of being able to create a new relationship, to be a part of each other's lives, because, you know, again, things as you know, I think she anticipated me having a family and wanting to be part of that. And it just, you know, the stuff in the past just didn't seem to matter as much.
And were you able to talk about your life and how things had changed for you, and how did that change for you? Did it create openings for you and recontextualize some of your past or not?
I think so. I think, you know, again, by that point, I was, pretty on my own path of sort of trying to be my own person and really just, you know, trying to focus on being a good person, being a kind person. And I think my mother saw that, you know, a lot different than the 14-year-old kid who, again, wasn't perfect and certainly had a lot of tendencies that, were stubborn and not, you know, teenage tendencies. I think while my wife might say I still have some of those, I try not to pull them out too often. So I think, you know, again, for both of us, we were able to kind of recontextualize the relationship in the here and now, rather than staying in the past where neither of us were anymore.
Tell us about your decision to come to UNC.
So when I decided to do an infectious disease fellowship, I knew I wanted to be somewhere that was doing great HIV work. Particularly work that was clinically based, so had a public health feel, because that was really my passion, rather than a lab. And so the schools that I applied at were sort of those that had public health schools. I came back here, and the first person I met was the fellowship director at the time. His name is Andy Kaplan, and he picked me up from my hotel, and his car was disgusting. It was covered in trash and just grossness. But he was the most amazing man that I had ever met, and I fell in love with him. And he was so smart, and I just knew that this was the right place for me. So
you became the lead investigator in some research that undiscovered, I should say, an HIV epidemic, a kind of hidden epidemic among young black men in the South.
Yeah, so, you know, again, as a fellow here at UNC, you know, the idea is that you become a researcher. Yeah. And I got involved with the North Carolina program that looked at finding acute infections, so people who are really early infected. And one day we're at sort of one of our meetings, and we noticed that there had been two new diagnoses of HIV in young black men. Both were around the same age. Both were attending college in North Carolina, and both reported sex with men. And so, you know, we looked kind of around and realized that there hadn't really been reports of HIV on college campuses. We thought it was something interesting. I think somebody said, you know, we should look into this. And then all eyes went to me, who was the most junior in the room. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And that was really sort of the beginning of really going from region to region, reviewing every case of HIV that had been diagnosed in the state for the last 10 years and piecing together what we found to be an outbreak that was happening on our college campuses.
Well, and those methods themselves were groundbreaking in some ways, and you met with some resistance in terms of how you went about uncovering this epidemic.
You know, I think that, you know, again, we, you know, again, groundbreaking, you know, I don't know. But I think we really wanted to figure out what was happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that the colleges were very worried that they would be seen as an HIV school. And we were very careful during that time to never mention a single college name or the number of cases on each, because it wasn't about that. It wasn't about an individual college. It was about a group of young men who were being impacted by the epidemic, and the fact that they were connected. And they were connected through colleges. They were connected through online sites that they were using. And we needed to figure out how to find more of them that didn't know they were infected and get them into care.
And tell us more about that, the differences in some of the extreme vulnerabilities or different vulnerabilities that young black men in the South found themselves in and the services they were using, et cetera, that complicated their situation.
Well, I think, you know, again, you know, we know that HIV is a disease that disproportionately impacts certain groups. And, you know, it sort of becomes sort of a question of why. For the young men that we found, I think it was a combination, sort of a multi-level issues. Structurally, you know, certainly we've talked about stigma and homophobia, and that impacts folks' ability to access prevention services and to access care once you're infected. We also know that those same inequalities impact people's behaviors. And their likelihood of engaging in condomless sex, and their likelihood of using substances, and their likelihood of having to exchange sex for money or do other things to stay alive. So I think, you know, it's a combination of issues, and what boils down to the fact is that less young black men at the time were being diagnosed, thus more had, you know, detectable virus. And thus, transmission, you know, was more likely to occur in these networks.
I'm talking with Lisa Hightoe-Weidman, an infectious disease specialist at UNC's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Disease, who specializes in HIV prevention. And we will continue our conversation on the state of things right after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Lisa Hightoe-Weidman, a professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Diseases. She also directs the Behavior and Technology Lab at the UNC School of Medicine. We're talking about your interest in infectious diseases, uncovering what was an epidemic in a particular population, young black men in the South who are having sex with other men. Also at this time, your personal life is continuing and you're in Chapel Hill and you meet the woman who would be your wife. Tell us about Jen.
So Jen and I met at a bar. We don't go to a lot of bars, but we happened to meet at a bar. And she, in sort of a very romantic way, challenged me to an arm wrestling match that she handily won. And and thus sparked sort of a romance that has lasted 16
years.
Was
this your goal? I'm gonna marry the first woman who can finally beat me at this? Or
No. You know, okay. Arm wrestling was not my forte, so I was not looking for that. But you know, I think, you know, in a lot of ways it was love at first sight.
Yeah. And you developed this relationship. It had to be because you were living then in very soon after that, a 700 square foot house in Durham. That was, from the description here, nearly unfit for habitation.
Right. It probably was. It was, yeah, 700 square feet. And I think that might have included part of the attic, at least the attic stairs. And, you know, Jen lived very, you know, sparsely, I will say. She was focused on her work. She was getting her PhD and exercise. And then I think... And NPR. She actually had a radio. That was like her main things that she had. So the area where the kitchen was, she had put a full-size washer and dryer because the stackables didn't clean her exercise gear well enough.
Whoa.
The first time I cooked there, I love to cook, and I turned on the oven to, you know, cook something, and I, you know, smelled smoke and soon realized that her oven was where she stored her 2 liters of diet soda.
Not much for cooking then.
Not much for cooking. She's not well known. She's well known for many, many things, but cooking is not her cup of tea.
Eventually, you got trapped in the attic and had to move. Tell us that story.
So the house was very small. So we basically rotated summer and winter attire. One of these days, I was up in the attic and. We realized we needed new stairs, and so we lifted the old stairs out of the attic, and realized that the stairs we had bought to replace it didn't fit, and so I was trapped up in the attic, and it was hot, and I'm up there. She says, "Well, I don't have a ladder. What am I going to do?" So, and I hear her outside because again it's very small, laughing and on the phone with her dad. And I'm, "Get me down!" So finally, she went over to a neighbor and we got some stairs. But after that, I said, "I'm not coming up here again." So, we're done.
We're done. You're moving. You're moving out. You stayed together. So it's again. Your personal life is evolving now. You're moving forward with that. You talked about Andy Kaplan, meeting him at UNC in the School of Public Health, and how important he was to you as a mentor. And then he passed away in 2006. At the time, you were pregnant. Tell us about what this is doing to you emotionally.
So I didn't know I was pregnant when he died. Jen and I had been trying for quite a while, actually over a year, to have a child. He passed away, and I found out I was pregnant, I think a week later. And I know because I drank heavily when he died, and was worried about that when I found out I was pregnant. But it was fine. You know, he was, like I said, he was my mentor. He was my friend. He was really the reason why I got my first grant, which I found out was, again, getting funded pretty soon after he died, of which he was, you know, the lead mentor on. So I credit really who I am, in, you know, from a research perspective, and who I try and be as a mentor to others, coming from him.
Well, talk about that first grant that you did receive funding for. Was that Project Style?
So we received Project Style, and then another grant called Health Empowerment around the same time. Project Style was a grant that really fed off of the college campus epidemic and sought to provide testing and care for those young men that were infected. And since I'm a physician as well as a researcher, I was able to create a clinic where we saw these young people right away, and a space where we tried to make them feel welcome and respected, and really provide the care that would want them to come back.
As you come up with or try to develop this treatment protocol, you talked about some of the resistance you met from college campuses who were worried about the research impact on their reputations. Were you still encountering that kind of resistance when it came to treatment?
Not when it came to treatment. I think, we had a little bit of resistance in that, we created a social marketing campaign to target young men who were having sex with men. And our first attempts were a little too graphic, I think, for the colleges. While they were willing to put up informational messages that alluded to, men having sex with men, they didn't want the graphic image presented. And I think for us that was a struggle because we wanted to make it very clear who we were wanting to work with and what we were about. But I think you have to make compromises because if you're not going to get your message out, then it doesn't matter how good it is. And so we compromised and we created a message that we thought would resonate with the young men, but also be allowed on the campuses. And for that, we're able to kind of continue the work.
And the second grant, I think, looked at the relationship between mobile technology and HIV prevention, right?
Yes. Yeah, so the second grant, so Health Empowerment, which I think of as my fourth child sometimes, it started again with this idea that young men were meeting each other on the internet. And, the internet was changing and it continues to evolve. But, at the time, there wasn't a lot of research using the internet to engage people in prevention. And so we created our own site. We created it with folks at UNC, and it was, interactive. It had a lot of features to engage young people to participate in sort of learning more about HIV, but also in having discussions with each other about the things that were really important, stigma, HIV-related stigma, racial stigma, relationships, health. And we just just finished our last interview with folks involved in the trial in October of last year.
Well, I wonder about the success in that, because it does seem that if you set up a site, for instance, generate the conversations or provide the space for that, it does suggest a willingness to enter that site. And since so much of what you describe around the problem is denial, the unwillingness to have graphic representations, the difficulty in telling family, all of those things that you've talked about. How does setting up this space, to what extent does denial become part of the problem? It won't happen to me. I'm not going to get this thing.
You know, again, we learned a lot. My team, I think, have learned a lot about how to engage, you know, people into a community that's artificial, right? It's sort of something we've created for them to have intense and, you know, interpersonal relationships that weren't there. And what we realized is that for some people that works. And there were some people on the site that used that site and said the most profound and introspective things that, you know, to me, I save them and read them sometimes because they're so important. For some people, it wasn't the right intervention. And, you know, an online space was not, you know, it didn't, no matter how much we did to engage them, that wasn't the place where they needed to be engaged. But again, the fact that, you know, we had over, I think, 1,100 posts. And again, we're talking, you know, 200 people that were assigned to the intervention site. So a lot of really intense conversations happened. And we're, you know, we're looking at that data now to see, how did that impact some of these outcomes that we've been talking about, like stigma and depression?
And what are you seeing?
Well, we're still in the very early stages of looking at the data. So, you know, again, our last interview closed.
This is the perfect time to just make something up.
That's right. No.
No.
I will avoid alternative facts.
Thank you.
But, again, promising results. So yeah. Our main outcome was a decrease in condomless sex. And we did see in the intervention group a decrease at the intervention completion. So, and it does look like those that had the most risky behavior were those that actually used the site the most. So we're my team from UNC and colleagues that are helping us at Duke are digging in. But a lot of promising and really interesting results.
That's great. So professionally, it's very gratifying for you at this moment here living in North Carolina, doing your important research and having these promising results. What about personally? Talk about your living in North Carolina. You have a wife, you're two gay moms living in the state of North Carolina. What's this like for you these days?
You know, we live in Chapel Hill, so I think, or we live in Chatham, but, you know, again, I think we work here. I work in a division that's very accepting. So I think, you know, many times we can go throughout our day without feeling any different, right, than other couples that happen to be heterosexual. I think when we're sort of crushed with what's happening in the political landscape, when we're sort of faced with, you know, the way our state votes on certain issues, like, you know, initially Amendment 1 and certainly HB 2, then I think we're the reality that, you know, there are folks out there that don't agree with us, you know, being married or having kids or, you know, frankly, existing. Mm. And I think, you know, that as parents now has become much more profound an issue than when it was just us or you know, we were just sort of living and not sort of thinking about other lives.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, and I wonder how you would take it in your situation, because Amendment 1, of course, was unconstitutional from the start, and it's finally been overturned by the courts. So that's a statement about the validity of that amendment. HB 2, the governor who supported it most deeply, is now out of office, saying something about the voters of North Carolina at large. And yet the conversation continues, and we can see our legislature is less affected. And so I wonder how sort of the net for you, what's the takeaway? The state of North Carolina, the court seemed to understand things one way, but there are still these tendencies that are very strong in our culture.
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately, those folks that who have such strong feelings against, you know, against same-sex marriage or really sort of any of these sort of issues, transgender rights, you know, tend to be the most outspoken, or at least they tended to be the most outspoken. I think that there's been a certainly a shift most recently. And I think those of us that that support, you know, love for all and really, you know, don't allow hate are speaking up quite a bit more. And for me, that's reaffirming. I mean, again, the election of our new governor was the only silver lining, I think, for me for November. But it does, I think, show that hopefully we'll start to see some changes if we can kind of get through this together.
Other fallout from the November election is the threat to ACA, the chance that might be dismantled. How would the repeal of ACA affect the patients who you're working with?
Well, a lot of our patients have coverage now. They couldn't get coverage prior to ACA because of pre-existing conditions. So certainly that threatens their ability to pay for their medicines and engage in care. Certainly in states where Medicaid expansion happened, the loss of ACA could impact that. In addition, I think any federal money that is going to support issues, including HIV or science and research for HIV, is at risk. And I think none of us feel safe with the current policies that are in play. I worry greatly about my patients. I worry not only about sort of the pure sort of financial or tangible pieces of losing insurance or not being able to afford medicines, but it's the message, right? The message that they're not welcome, that they're not worth caring for, and I think that those are messages that keep people from getting HIV tested. They keep people from disclosing their status. They keep people from taking their medicines, and that's what keeps the epidemic going.
Well, I wonder if there's any correlation between that and generally the cultural and political situation in the South, because the last time I looked, the rates of HIV and AIDS diagnoses are higher in the South. What explains that?
I think, again, you sort of nailed it. I mean, I think it's, number one, I think for a long time, the big cities were sort of, the epicenters, and I think got a lot more attention and did more research. And, I think we've come out strong in the South, a lot of us, researchers, certainly not just our group. But, certainly there is, structural inequalities, and these inequalities are glaring in the South in terms of stigma, homophobia, and incarceration rates, and all of these things contribute to keeping HIV alive.
And just briefly, and this has to be my last question, but I know that HB2 has had an impact, and you were doing some clinical work around transgender individuals. How is this affecting you?
So, again, HB2 is really just sort of a law that intends to discriminate for no actual factual reasons. In our clinic, we do now provide hormone therapy for transgender clients because it's an important part of their health care. So while, again, I'm not an endocrinologist, a few of us in the clinic have self-taught ourselves how to prescribe hormones because it's important. Somebody who works with me, one of my employees is one of the plaintiffs. And his, journey has been, I think, inspiring for all of us that work together. I think, we're really we're amazed at his sort of strength to fight this case. And I think, for all of us that work together, I think it continues to help us remember, the importance of all that we do to continue to support, equality.
Thank you for your good work, Lisa. Good to talk with you.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Hightel-Weidman is an infectious diseases specialist at UNC's Institute for Global Health and Infectious Disease. Also the director of Behavior and Technology Lab at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine. And you can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.